In your Bibles to Paul's letter to the Philippians and chapter 2. Last week we looked at the passage ending at verse 11. We're just looking at a very short section this morning, verses 12 to 14. So I'll just read those verses now. Philippians 2. Verse 12, therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Do all things without grumbling or questioning. So Paul, in these verses, continues to talk about the humble, peaceable, selfless behavior that he has been talking about. And as he does so, this is the thing that I want you to notice. He manages to be both unrelenting and uplifting. Both those adjectives fit verses 12 to 14, so that in one sense, we go away from this text sobered and chastened because Paul has been unrelenting. But in another sense, we go away animated and resolute because Paul has been uplifting. And in the light of all that, then, I have two main headings this morning. And first of all, an unrelenting load of pears. And that's P-A-I-R. We're not talking about fruit here. An unrelenting load of pears. What do I mean by that? Well, in these verses, Paul hits us with a barrage of word pairs, one after another after another. And in doing so, then, he kind of leaves us reeling. It's an effective way of really impressing upon us the behavior that's required of us. Let me show you these word pairs. Let's work through them. And we'll start, actually, with the one that's mentioned last, grumbling and quarreling. Grumbling and quarreling, and that's there in verse 14. Now, you'll see that in the ESV, it's actually grumbling and questioning, but questioning seems too vague and mild a translation in this context. In 1 Timothy 2, verse 8, the ESV is happy to translate the same Greek word, quarreling. I can't really understand its reluctance to do so here. So that's what we'll call this word pair in verse 14, grumbling and quarreling. What then is the behavior that Paul is requiring of us Christians? Well, we've seen how he describes it back in verses 3 and 4. We've talked about that. Here he describes it in a slightly different way. It's behavior, he says, free from grumbling and quarreling. That is what is required of us. What's grumbling? Well, the type of grumbling that Paul means here is this. It's getting into conversation with someone over coffee after the service in the foyer out there. And once in conversation, lowering your voice and offloading on that person your frustrations about and bitter criticisms of another church member. Or perhaps instead of that, doing it by means of a phone call during the week, in which you say, when I was talking to you over coffee after the service last Sunday morning, I didn't tell you about so-and-so, did I? And you then rattle off down the phone a list of that other church member's flaws and failings as you see them. That's the grumbling that Paul has in mind here. This past week, as some of you will be aware, the preacher and author Tim Keller died. I read a tribute to him by Don Carson. The two men were close friends. And one line in his tribute stood out to me. Carson says this. He says, "Not once did I ever see Tim on the verge of losing it, still less of descending to catty or condescending assessments of others." Isn't that great? No catty or condescending assessments of others. He's really saying Tim Keller wasn't a grumbler. I wonder, could a sentence like that honestly be written about you once you're gone? Not once in all my conversations with her over coffee after a service at NREC did she ever descend to catty or condescending assessments of others. Or, in fact, might your obituary writer be sorely tempted to use the G word? Sadly, when talking about her fellow church members, she could be a right grumbler. So that's grumbling, and then quarrelling. Well, quarrelling is allowing differences of opinion, which of course will always exist between us to some degree and are not in themselves a problem. Quarrelling is allowing differences of opinion to dominate and disrupt our relationships. It's allowing them to eclipse and supplant that respect and affection which we owe one another. Quarrellers care out of all proportion about making their views known and about winning arguments. These are huge priorities to quarrellers. Quarrellers depersonalize those around them. So there's another church member sitting in front of you this morning, but you don't see him as a flesh and blood brother in the Lord Jesus. You see him as just a set of opinions on legs. Not above all else a brother to be loved and valued, but a set of opinions to be confronted and pulled apart. So grumbling and quarrelling, that's this word pair that Paul uses here in verse 14. And it's a strong word pair. And my question is then, how are we doing this morning in relation to those deadly activities? And they really are deadly activities, you know. They are like a cancer that gets inside a church. And its toxic presence grows and grows until eventually there's no life left in that church fellowship. This is really serious stuff that we're talking about here. We must beware grumbling about each other. We must beware quarreling with each other. Perhaps more than ever at this juncture in the life of our church, we must beware those things. But the barrage is only beginning. We must move on to a second word pair here, presence and absence. Presence and absence. And this is verse 12. One feature of events like the coronation that took place the other Saturday or the Queen's funeral a few months ago is that you see the leading members of different political parties who normally are tearing shreds out of each other in the House of Commons. You see them there sitting in Westminster Abbey or somewhere, and they're alongside each other and they're seemingly getting on very amicably. Because we humans have the capacity to snap out of bitter conflicts and, if necessary, show a bit of solidarity for a few hours or a few days or however long may be required. And Paul is conscious then, as he writes here, that if he were to visit Philippi the next day, and of course that's not possible because he's in prison, but if he were to visit Philippi the next day, he would probably have a delightful time with them. He would find a congregation full of smiles and laughter and general social graces on display. How come? Because they are, in fact, a united church family whose members are overflowing with affection for each other? Well, no, much of this letter wouldn't be needed if that were the case. Rather, because they are being watched by the Apostle Paul in those circumstances. And so like those politicians at the coronation or the funeral, they are turning on the solidarity. That's why he would find everything hunky-dory if he were to show up in Philippi tomorrow. Now, Paul could conclude from that, right, I'm going to install CCTV cameras throughout Lydia's house or wherever the church's meeting place might be. Then, potentially at least, I'm always watching these people, and so they'll always be on their best behavior. No grumbling, no quarreling. Or a more realistic version of that, given that CCTV cameras probably weren't available to the Apostle Paul, I'm going to make sure that a member of my team is always stationed in Philippi, Timothy and Titus, and Silas and the others, they can rotate. They can have a rota a few months each in Philippi, and they'll act as my eyes on that congregation. And so good behavior from the Philippians will be guaranteed. No grumbling, no quarreling. But Paul doesn't think like that. Instead, he demands of these Philippians that they quit grumbling and quarreling, even though there are no cameras installed in Lydia's house, even though none of his team members are there, even though they're not in any sense being watched by the Apostle Paul, even though he is thoroughly and unambiguously absent from them. He wants that to make no difference. Not only, he says, as in my presence, but much more in my absence. Behave properly, whether I'm present or whether I'm absent. In other words, he doesn't want them to pass the grumbling and quarreling test merely at the easiest point. He wants them to pass it at the hardest point, when he's hundreds of miles away from them and they are completely beyond his field of vision, and he's not breathing down their necks intimidatingly, and they have no reason, therefore, to put on a show. He wants them then to pass the grumbling and quarreling test. That's a challenging thought, isn't it? Passing the grumbling and quarreling test at the hardest point. You see, perhaps you wouldn't grumble about that other church member over coffee in the foyer out there after a service, or even in that phone call during the week. You're too classy for that. You would never risk looking like a grumbler, gaining a reputation in the church for being a troublemaker. You wouldn't risk that. But perhaps there's some context in which you would let down your guard. Perhaps sitting with your spouse on the sofa at the very end of the Lord's Day. Perhaps then the level of privacy is such that you'll start to rant and rave about people in the church and all their perceived faults. Or perhaps it's when you're with a close friend during the week who goes to a different church. And that's when all your issues with your own fellow church members start to pour out. And it's in those contexts then, those contexts where grumbling is risk-free, it's there especially that we need to clamp down on it. That, I'm saying, is the force of this second word pair here, presence and absence. And that leads then very naturally to a third word pair, willing and working. Willing and working, and this is verse 13. We talk, don't we, about biting our tongues. I don't mean literally when you're playing rugby or something. It's a phrase that we use. You're about to say something, and it's there on the very tip of your tongue, but in that very last millisecond before it comes out of your mouth, you stop yourself from saying it. You bite your tongue. It might be a piece of information that really ought to remain confidential. It might be an exciting surprise that must not be spoiled. It might be a jokey comment that's clever and witty, but could be taken the wrong way and cause some offence. And so you have to perform a Basil Fawlty on yourself. Don't mention the war, only hopefully with more success than him. You have to suppress the utterance, hold it in, keep it just this unexpressed, unarticulated thought inside your head. That's the art of biting your tongue. Now, here's my question. Is that what Paul wants here? So you've gotten that person cornered over coffee after the service, and you're about half a second away from beginning your grumble, and you reluctantly stop yourself on the brink. Or because, as I said a moment ago, you're too classy for that kind of situation anyway, you're instead on that sofa alongside your spouse and about half a second away from beginning your grumble, and you reluctantly stop yourself on the brink. Is that the kind of thing that Paul wants? Well, I'm sure Paul would say that biting your tongue is better than not biting your tongue and allowing the grumble out in those circumstances. Biting your tongue is a demonstration of self-control, and self-control is an important concept for the Apostle Paul. However, Paul really wants more than that here. Let me put it this way. He wants the battle with grumbling and quarreling to be won in the heart, not merely in the vocal cords. Or in the language of our text, he wants it to be won in our wills, both to will and to work, he says. He's talking about the believer's taste here. He's talking about the believer's fundamental preferences. Because I'm getting old, I have to be careful now that I don't overstimulate myself by drinking coffee too late in the evening. And I can manage it. I can look at my watch, decide it's too close to bedtime for coffee, and make myself a hot chocolate instead. I can do that. But it doesn't alter the fact that I'd much rather be making myself a lovely strong mug of coffee. I'm saying my evening drink-making practice may have changed in recent years, but my taste hasn't. My fundamental preferences haven't. I do dutifully abstain from coffee in the latter stages of the day, but my heart isn't in that abstention. I read that passage from Ephesians a few minutes ago. I'm struck by a couple of buts which Paul uses in those verses. So Ephesians 4:29, Paul writes, "Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up, as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear." And then chapter 5, verse 4, "Let there be no filthiness, nor foolish talk, nor crude joking, which are out of place, but instead, let there be thanksgiving." Do you see the significance of those buts? Paul doesn't have in view a bit of tongue biting when some corrupting talk is about to come out of the Ephesians' mouths. He doesn't have in view a bit of tongue biting when some filthiness is about to come out of the Ephesians' mouths. He has in view something bigger and more pervasive. He has in view a taste for, a preference for, an inclination towards a different kind of speech altogether. Speech that is wholesome and upbuilding. Speech that is full of thanksgiving. And that's what Paul has in view here too, when he mentions not only working, but also willing. He doesn't want us to refrain from grumbling and quarreling the way that I refrain from coffee. He wants us to love the hot chocolate, or rather in this case, to love conversation that is the opposite of grumbling and quarreling. He wants our hearts to be in this abstention, the way that mine isn't as I make my drink in the evening. He wants our whole wills to be inclined towards lovely speech, beautiful speech, refreshing, invigorating speech. In other words, it isn't just a case of not talking to that person out in the foyer after the service, because that way I won't start grumbling about that other church member. It's a case of talking to that person in the foyer after the service, keen, in the language of a later part of this letter, keen to talk about things that are true and noble and right and pure and lovely and admirable and excellent and praiseworthy. It's at that that we should be aiming. Not just suppressing grumbling and quarreling. That may be a necessary starting point. But we should be aiming at much more than that. At a will, a heart, an inclination that is toward a wholly different kind of talking. So grumbling and quarreling, presence and absence, working and willing and working, and then one more word pair, fear and trembling. Fear and trembling, that's in verse 12. Many years ago, I was the best man at my friend's wedding. And some of you will know then that that is a hugely nerve-wracking business. Nothing is calculated to ruin a lovely meal, quite like having to give a best man speech immediately afterwards. You're in fear and trembling at the prospects. Why? It's not because you haven't prepared a good speech. You've probably spent months mulling it over. It's not because you're liable to any kind of punishment should the speech be a flop. People will probably feel sorry for you more than anything else. No, it's because giving a best man speech is just an intrinsically weighty responsibility. It matters. This is your friend's big day. He has honored you greatly by giving you this role. It's not a casual little responsibility. On other occasions, your friend might ask you to go and buy a pint of milk for him next time you're at the corner shop. Or he might ask you to help him carry an item of furniture up his stairs. Those are casual little responsibilities. There's no fear and trembling when he asks you to do those things. But when he asks you to give a best man speech at his wedding, that's different. Just again, going back to Ephesians and a later section of that letter, it's interesting that Paul in chapter 6 and verse 5 of Ephesians uses this same phrase, fear and trembling. And he's addressing the slaves in the Ephesian congregation. Chapter 6, verse 5, he says, "Slaves, obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling." And there's no hint that he's just thinking here of those masters that are very austere and harsh. I mean, in that case, he wouldn't have to tell them to have fear and trembling anyway. Now, it's clear from all the expressions that he stacks up alongside fear and trembling in that verse, with a sincere heart, not by the way of eye service as people pleasers, from the heart. It's clear from all those different expressions that he stacks up there in Ephesians 6 verse 5 that he's wanting these slaves to take their daily lives as slaves seriously. You see, they could have thought, well, this is irrelevant to my Christianity. My daily life as a slave in that person's house, that's an unimportant area of my life before God. God's not interested in that. As long as I pray, as long as I don't have sex outside of marriage, as long as I don't get drunk, as long as I keep all those commandments, that's all the kind of stuff that God is interested in. How I serve my master and perform my slave tasks day in, day out, that's unimportant. As far as God is concerned, that's a casual, inconsequential business. And Paul is saying there in Ephesians 6, verse 5, no, it matters. It matters. God is intensely interested in that whole dimension of your life. Being a person of integrity and uprightness as you do your master's work day after day, that is an intrinsically weighty responsibility. Do it with fear and trembling. That's what Paul is saying. And he's making then the same point here in our passage. The point is that living free from grumbling and quarreling at both the level of will and work, that's not a casual little responsibility. Because evangelism, that's the really big thing. Being a mover and a shaker and changing the world for Jesus, that's the really big thing. This is just low-level stuff. God doesn't care whether I grumble and quarrel or not in the gatherings of my church. No, Paul is saying it matters. It matters. It's an intrinsically weighty responsibility, this that I'm laying before you, Paul is saying, that should be approached like giving a best man speech with fear and with trembling. Each February, Mike Johnson helpfully produces an address list for us of the members and friends of this congregation, and obviously, it's useful if we want to contact one another. But perhaps that list of names is also a useful opportunity just to look at all those names and to take a deep breath and say to ourselves, I am called to be a brother or sister to all those people. I am called to love each one of them for another year until next February's address list comes out. I'm called to love each one of them without a single grumble and without a single quarrel. And that's a weighty responsibility. That's something to pause over, to linger over, to take time to reflect upon. It's a big deal. That's the significance, I'm saying, of this fourth word pair, fear and trembling. So, an unrelenting load of pairs. Grumbling and quarreling, presence and absence, willing and working, fear and trembling. It leaves us reeling, as I said earlier. And that's good. We should feel that this is serious business. This behavior that Paul is setting before us, that he is calling upon the Philippians and upon us to practice. We should be reeling. But it's also why we then need to move on, secondly and more briefly, from an unrelenting load of pears to an uplifting lack of panic. An uplifting lack of panic. And by that I mean then, in the mood of the Apostle Paul. You see, he knows something of what's going on in Philippi. In fact, it's clear from chapter 4 when he comes to talk about Euodia and Syntyche, he knows in great detail what's going on in this Philippian church. He knows that situation between those two women is rumbling on, and probably it's not the only one. There are probably other relational breakdowns in this congregation. He knows about it all. And he might well then be back there in Rome panicking. This is a church he has planted, a church that is close to his heart. He might well be panicking that the whole thing is just going to unravel. All these relationships that are going pear-shaped, if you'll excuse the pun from my earlier point. And it might just dissolve. And he's in a prison cell, all those miles away. And he doesn't have a magic wand that he can wave to sort out all these relational problems. All he has is a pen. That's all he can wave, a pen. Surely he's fighting a losing battle, simply writing a letter from far off Rome when grumbling and quarreling is so prevalent in this church. Surely this is a case where Paul should just panic. But he doesn't. In the midst of this unrelenting load of pears, there is also this uplifting lack of panic. And that's based then on two factors. First of all, a past event. A past event. Do you remember how last week we talked about verse 6 and the way in which Paul uses two different phrases to refer to the same thing? Verse 6, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped. And those two phrases then, form of God and equality with God, clearly have the same significance. And we have a similar kind of variation going on in a verse here in our passage. And it's there in verse 12. He says, therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, but much more in my absence, obey. He could say that. That's what he means. But the second time, he doesn't use the word obey again. He replaces obey with work out your own salvation. Now, this isn't a text that we should get troubled about. Paul doesn't here say work out your own salvation. He doesn't say work up your own salvation. He says work out your own salvation. Or you could translate it carry out. In Romans 7 verse 18, Paul translates the same Greek verb in that way. Carry it out. In other words, implement it. That's what Paul is saying. Put your salvation into effect. Let me use a slightly contrived illustration. But imagine then that there's a child that's been kidnapped. And the child is there locked in a cage. And you hear about this situation and that the kidnappers are demanding a ransom for this child. And so you decide you're going to save this child. And so you go and you pay the money that's being required. And so the door of that cage is unlocked and is swung open. The child has been saved. But as you stand beside that cage, the child just sits there at the back, of the cage. Well, what do you do then? Do you just shrug your shoulders and go away happy? Because after all, you've saved the child, you've paid the money, the door's been unlocked and swung open, the child's saved, you go away happy. No. You want that child to actually implement, put into effect this salvation that the child now possesses. You want him or her to go out of the cage and play football and climb trees and get an education and all the things that children do. And so you stay beside that cage and you encourage that child to come out. But you do so smilingly. If the door of the cage was still locked, then that would be different. Then you might suggest to the child, well, go and try and shake that door hard. Or go and try and find a hole in the door that you can squeeze through. But you would do so heavy-heartedly, knowing that it was a pretty hopeless business. But when the child has been saved, and all that child needs to do is live out that salvation that you have secured for the child, you're confident. You smile. Come on, just come out of the cage. And that's Paul here writing to these Philippians. These Philippians have been saved from the sin that once chained them. If they were still chained by sin, then Paul could tell them until he was blue in the face, do all things without grumbling or quarreling. But he would do so with a sense of hopelessness in his heart, knowing that there was no real possibility of them doing that. But they've been saved. He's simply calling on them to live out that salvation. Do you realize, if you're a Christian this morning, that you have been saved from sin? That may seem a very, 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 very elementary thing to say, but actually I think it's a very, very, very misunderstood thing. Note my words, I'm not saying you have been saved from the punishment, although that's true. I'm not saying you've been saved from hell, although that's true. I'm not saying you've been saved from your estrangement with God, although that's true. The point I'm making here is more specific than that. You've been saved from sin. Sin. Let's be more concrete still in the terms of our text. You've been saved from grumbling and quarreling. The door out of that kind of existence has been unlocked and has swung open. Philippians 2:14 here isn't calling on you to perform some Herculean feat and somehow free yourself from the grip that grumbling and quarreling has on the human heart. You've been freed from that grip if you're a Christian believer. It's simply calling on you to put into practice the saved situation that is actually yours. To be in practice the saved person that you actually are. To live in the light of what has happened to you at conversion. To give expression to it in your daily lives and relationships. That's what Paul is asking here. He's not asking you to go and climb some ridiculous Mount Everest. He's saying you're already at the top. You've been saved. Live like it, folks. That's what he's saying. And so, there's no panic in Paul. If he were writing to unsaved people, then he would snap his pen in two, rip up his page, and abandon the whole thing. It'd be pointless. You can't tell people who are chained by sin to quit their grumbling and quarreling, but you can tell people who have been saved to simply work out that salvation, implement it, live it out, carry it out. Put it into practice in conversations over coffee after church. And so, understand, you believers here this morning, this past event, you've been saved from lots of things, but you've been saved specifically from sin, amongst those other things. From its grip, its power, its reign, its tyrannical hold that once it had on your heart, which meant you were helpless. You couldn't resist it. That's not the case anymore. You've been saved from that. Live out your salvation. So there's no panic in Paul. And that's partly on the basis of a past event, but then secondly, it's also on the basis of a present enterprise. A present enterprise, because it's even better than what we've just been outlining. In addition to this release from the chains of sin which takes place at conversion, in addition to that, there is then an ongoing work of God in the lives of Christians, producing in them, at the two levels we've talked about, willing and working, producing in them this ungrumbling, unquarreling love for one another. That's what Paul is saying, for it is God who works in you, both to will and to work. There's the breaking of the chains at conversion, and then after conversion, there's this ongoing work of God producing the very thing that Paul is requiring here. And I'm calling it an enterprise, not just because of the alliterative relationship with event, but because I'm trying to get this across, that this isn't some kind of burdensome role which God performs grudgingly. Oh, crumbs, here's another convert that I've got to work in over the next 5 or 6 decades. I've got to produce in this other person love and humility and get rid of all their grumbling and all their quarreling. And he relishes this project. He relishes it. That's what I mean when I say it's an enterprise. How do I know that? Well, the text says so. For it is God who works in you both to will and to work for his good pleasure. It's like a craftsman who takes some piece of old driftwood that he's found on the beach, and it's all gnarled and it's got seaweed on it and it doesn't look in great shape at all. And he forms from that piece of old driftwood some elegant salad bowl or something. And it's a labor of love. And he takes great pride in the whole thing. And that's the picture that Paul is giving us here of the way that God works in you and me, producing out of these twisted, perverted, polluted hearts of ours that we had at conversion, producing out of those an ungrumbling, unquarreling, loving attitude toward our brothers and sisters. And this fact then that God is at work doing this, it doesn't cause Paul to go easy on the Philippians. It doesn't make him allergic to setting forth strong commands as he writes to them. He has this unrelenting load of pears that we've talked about as he impresses on them that they need to deal with their grumbling and their quarreling. But it does mean that there's no panic in the Apostle Paul. There's no panic in him. He refuses to regard even Euodia and Syntyche as a lost cause. They're not a lost cause when the great divine craftsman is committed to making their hearts as beautiful as his son's heart. And so, let's, all of us who are believers this morning, live out our salvation, dealing with all those remains of grumbling and quarreling that there are in our hearts. For it is God who works in us, both to will and to work, for his good pleasure. Knowing that we shall be successful, because God, behind our little efforts, is doing his mighty, beautiful, glorious efforts. Amen.